I managed to pick up a bit of information here and there. I've got a few people in the palace and a minor official at the Tonedrin Embassy. The Tonedrins are very thorough.
He grinned impishly.
It's cheaper to let them do all the work than buy the information after they've gathered it.
If you can believe what they tell you, Hittar suggested.
Well, I never take what they say at face value. The Tonedrin ambassador knows that I've bought this man. He tries to trip me up with false leads now and then.
Does the ambassador know that you know?
Of course he does. But he doesn't think that I'm aware of the fact that he knows that I know.
He laughed again.
It's all terribly complicated, isn't it?
Most Drasnian games usually are,
Barak observed. Does the name Zadar mean anything to you?
I've heard it, naturally.
Has he been in touch with Salmisra?
Droblik frowned.
Couldn't say for sure. I haven't heard that he has. But that doesn't mean that he hasn't. This is a murky sort of place, and Salmisra's palace is the murkiest spot in the whole country. You wouldn't believe some of the things that go on there.
Oh, I believe them. And probably things you have not even begun to guess.
She turned back to the others.
I think we are at a standstill. We cannot make any kind of move until we hear from Silk and the old wolf.
Could I offer you my house?
Droblik asked.
I think we will stay on board Captain Greldick's ship, she told him. As you say, Nyssa is a murky place, and I am sure that the Tolnedran ambassadors bought a few people in your establishment.
Naturally. But I know who they are.
We'd better not chance it. There are several reasons for our avoiding Tolnedrans just now. We'll stay aboard the ship and keep out of sight. Let us know as soon as Prince Keldor gets in touch with you.
Of course. You'll have to wait until the rain lets up, though. Listen to it.
There was the thundering sound of a downpour on the roof overhead.
Will it last long? Durnick asked.
Droblik shrugged.
An hour or so, usually. It rains every afternoon during this season.
I imagine it helps to cool the air.
Not significantly. Usually it just makes things worse.
He mopped the sweat from his fat face.
How can you live here? Durnick asked him.
Droblik smiled blandly.
Fat men don't move around all that much. I'm making a great deal of money. And the game I'm playing with the Tonedrin ambassador keeps my mind occupied. It's not all that bad, once you get used to it. It helps if I keep telling myself that.
They sat quietly then, listening to the pounding rain. Chapter 25 For the next several days, they all remained aboard Greldick's ship, waiting for word from Silk and Mr. Wolf. Tineda recovered from her indisposition, and appeared on deck wearing a pale-colored dryad tunic, which seemed to Geryon to be only slightly less revealing than the gowns worn by Naissan women. When he rather stiffly suggested that she ought to put on a few more clothes, however, she merely laughed at him. With a single-mindedness that made him want to grind his teeth, she returned to the task of teaching him to read and write. They sat together in an out-of-the-way spot on deck, poring over a tedious book on Tolnedran diplomacy. The whole business seemed to Geryon to be taking forever, though in fact his mind was very quick, and he was learning surprisingly fast. Tineldra was too thoughtless to compliment him, though she seemed to await his next mistake almost breathlessly, delighting, it seemed, in each opportunity to ridicule him. Her proximity and her light, spicy perfume distracted him as they sat close beside each other, and he perspired as much from their occasional touch of hand or arm or hip as he did from the climate. Because they were both young, she was intolerant, and he was stubborn. The sticky, humid heat made them both short-tempered and irritable, so the lessons erupted into bickering more often than not. When they arose one morning, a black, square-rigged Naissan ship rocked in the river current at a nearby wharf. A foul, evil kind of reek carried to them from her on the fitful morning breeze.
"What is that smell?"
Garion asked one of the sailors.
"Slaver,"
the sailor answered grimly, pointing at the Naesan ship.
"You can smell them 20 miles away when you're at sea."
Garion looked at the ugly black ship and shuddered. Barak and Mandrallan drifted across the deck and joined Garion at the rail.
"Looks like a scow," Barak said of the Naesan ship, his voice heavy with contempt.
He was stripped to the waist, and his hairy torso ran with sweat.
"It's a slave ship," Garion told him.
"Smells like a open sewer," Barak complained. "A good fire would improve it tremendously."
"A sorry trade, my lord Barak," Mandrallan said. "This hath dealt in human misery for untold centuries."
"Is that a Drasnian wharf?"
Barak asked with narrowed eyes.
"No," Garion answered. "The sailors say that everything on that side is Naesan."
"That's a shame," Barak growled.
A group of mail-shirted men in black cloaks walked out onto the wharf where the slave ship was moored and stopped near the vessel's stern.
"Uh-oh," Barak said. "Where is Hetar?"
"He's still below. What's the matter?"
"Keep an eye out for him. Those are Murgos."
The shaven-head Naesan sailors pulled open a hatch on their ship and barked a few rough orders down into the hold. Slowly, a line of dispirited-looking men came up. Each man wore an iron collar, and a long chain fastened them together. Mandrallan stiffened and began to swear.
"What's wrong?"
"Erendish men. I had heard of this, but I did not believe it," the knight exclaimed.
"Heard of what?"
"An ugly rumor hath persisted in Arendia for some years."
Mandrallan was answering with his face white with rage.
"We are told that some of our nobles have upon occasion enriched themselves by selling their serfs to the Naesans."
"Looks like it's more than a rumor."
"There," Mandrallan growled. "See that crest upon the tunic of that one there? It is the crest of Votoral. I know the Baron of Votoral for a notorious spendthrift, but had not thought him dishonorable. Upon my return to Arendia, I will denounce him publicly."
"What good is that going to do?"
"He will be forced to challenge me. I will prove his villainy upon his body."
Barak shrugged.
"Serf or slave, what is the difference?"
"Those men have rights, my lord," Mandrallan stated. "Their lord is required to protect them and care for them. The oath of knighthood demands it of us. This vile transaction hath stained the honor of every true Arendish knight. I shall not rest until I have bereft that foul baron of his miserable life."
"Interesting idea. Maybe I'll go with you."
Hetar came up on deck, and Barak moved immediately to his side and began talking quietly to him, holding one of his arms firmly.
"Make them jump around a bit,"
one of the Murgos ordered harshly.
"I want to see how many are lame."
A heavy-shouldered Naesan uncoiled a long whip and began to flick it deftly at the legs of the chained men. The slaves began to dance feverishly on the wharf beside the slave ship.
"Dog's blood,"
Mandrallan swore, and his knuckles turned white as he gripped the railing.
"Easy,"
Garion warned.
"Aunt Paul says we're supposed to stay pretty much out of sight."
"It cannot be borne," Mandrallan cried.
The chain that bound the slaves together was old and pitted with rust. When one slave tripped and fell, a link snapped and the man found himself suddenly free. With an agility born of desperation, he rolled quickly to his feet, took 2 quick steps, and plunged off the wharf into the murky waters of the river.
"This way, man!"
Mandrallan called to the swimming slave. The burly Naesan with the whip laughed harshly and pointed at the escaping slave.
"What?"
he told the Murgos.
"Stop him, you idiot!"
one of the Murgos snapped.
I paid good gold for him.
It's too late.
The Niacin looked on with an ugly grin.
What?
The swimming man suddenly shrieked and sank out of sight. When he came up again, his face and arms were covered with the slimy, foot-long leeches that infested the river. Screaming, the struggling man tore at the writhing leeches, ripping out chunks of his own flesh in his efforts to pull them off. The Murgos began to laugh. Garion's mind exploded. He gathered himself with an awful concentration, pointed one hand at the wharf just beyond their own ship, and said,
"Be there."
He felt an enormous surge, as if some vast tide were rushing out of him, and he reeled, almost senseless, against Mandarallan. The sound inside his head was deafening. The slave, still writhing and covered with the oozing leeches, was suddenly lying on the wharf. A wave of exhaustion swept over Garion. If Mandarallan had not caught him, he would have fallen.
"Where did he go?"
Berek demanded, still staring at the turbulent spot on the surface of the river where the slave had been an instant before.
"Did he go under?"
Wordlessly and with a shaking head, Mandarallan pointed at the slave who lay still weakly struggling on the Drasnian wharf about 20 yards in front of the bow of their ship. Berek looked at the slave, then back at the river. The big man blinked with surprise. A small boat with 4 Nasons at the oars put out from the other wharf and moved deliberately toward Greldick's ship. A tall Murgo stood in the bow, his scarred face angry.
"You have my property,"
he shouted across the intervening water.
"Return the slave to me at once."
"Why don't you come and claim him, Murgo?"
Berek called back. He released Hattar's arm. The Algar moved to the side of the ship, stopping only to pick up a long boat hook.
"Will I be unmolested?"
the Murgo asked a bit doubtfully.
"Why don't you come alongside, and we'll discuss it,"
Berek suggested pleasantly.
"You are denying me my rights to my own property,"
the Murgo complained.
"Not at all," Berek told him. "Of course there might be a fine point of law involved here. This wharf is Drasnian territory, and slavery is not legal in Drasnia. Since that's the case, the man's not a slave anymore."
"I'll get my men," the Murgo said. "We'll take a slave by force if we have to."
"I think we'd have to look on that as an invasion of Alorn territory,"
Berek warned, with a great show of regret.
"In the absence of our Drasnian cousins, we would almost be compelled to take steps to defend our wharf for them. What do you think, Mandarallan?"
"Thy perceptions are most acute, my lord," Mandarallan replied. "By common usage, honorable men are morally obliged to defend the territory of kinsmen in their absence."
"There," Berek said to the Murgo. "You see how it is. My friend here is an Arund, so he is totally neutral in this matter. I think we'd have to accept his interpretation of the affair."
Greldick's sailors had begun to climb the rigging by now, and they clung to the ropes like great, evil-looking apes, fingering their weapons and grinning at the Murgo.
"There is yet another way,"
the Murgo said ominously. Garion could feel a force beginning to build, and a faint sound seemed to echo inside his mind. He drew himself up, putting his hands on the wooden rail in front of him. He felt a terrible weakness, but he steeled himself and tried to gather his strength.
"That's enough of that," Aunt Paul said crisply, coming up on deck with Durnick and Zenidra behind her.
"We were merely having a little legal discussion," Berek said innocently.
"I know what you were doing," she snapped. Her eyes were angry. She looked coldly across the intervening stretch of the river at the Murgo. "You had better leave."
"I have something to retrieve first,"
the man in the boat called back.
"I would forget about it."
"We will see," he said.
He straightened and began muttering as if to himself, his hands moving rapidly in a series of intricate gestures. Garion felt something pushing at him almost like a wind, though the air was completely still.
"Oh, be sure you get it right," Aunt Paul advised quietly. If you forget even the tiniest part of it, it will explode in your face.
The man in the boat froze, and a faintly worried frown crossed his face. The secret wind that had been pushing at Garion stopped. The man began again, his fingers weaving in the air, and his face fixed with concentration.
You do it like this, Grollum, Aunt Paul said.
She moved her hand slightly, and Garion felt a sudden rush, as if the wind pushing at him had turned and begun to blow the other way. The Grollum threw his hands up and reeled back, stumbling and falling into the bottom of his boat. As if he had been given a heavy push, the boat surged backward several yards. The Grollum, half raised, his eyes wide and his face deathly pale.
Return to your master, dog, Aunt Paul said scathingly. Tell him to beat you for not learning your lessons properly.
The Grollum spoke quickly to the Nissens at the oars, and they immediately turned the boat and rowed back toward the slave ship.
We had a nice little fight brewing there, Polgara. Why did you have to spoil it?
Barak complained. Grow up, she ordered bluntly. Then she turned on Garion, her eyes blazing and the white lock at her brow like a streak of fire.
You idiot! You refuse any kind of instruction, and then you burst out like a raging bull. Have you the slightest conception of what an uproar translocation causes? You have alerted every Grollum and Stithistor to the fact that we are here. He was dying, Garion protested, gesturing helplessly at the slave lying on the wharf. I had to do something. He was dead as soon as he hit the water. Look at him.
The slave had stiffened into an arched posture of mortal agony. His head twisted back and his mouth was agape. He was obviously dead.
What happened to him?
Garion asked, feeling suddenly sick.
The leeches are poisonous. Their bites paralyze their victims so that they can feed on them undisturbed. The bites stopped his heart. You exposed us to the Grollums for the sake of a dead man.
Well, he wasn't dead when I did it,
Garion shouted at her.
He was screaming for help.
He was angrier than he had ever been in his life.
He was beyond help.
Her voice was cold, even brutal.
What kind of monster are you?
He asked from between clenched teeth.
Don't you have any feelings? You would have just let him die, wouldn't you? I don't think this is the time or the place to discuss it. No. This is the time, right now, Aunt Paul. You're not even human, did you know that? You left being human behind so long ago that you can't even remember where you lost it. You're 3,000 years old. Our whole lives go by while you blink your eyes. We're just an entertainment for you, an hour's diversion. You manipulate us like puppets for your own amusement. Well, I'm tired of being manipulated. You and I are finished.
It probably went further than he had intended, but his anger had finally run away with him, and the words seemed to rush out before he could stop them. She looked at him, her face as pale as if he had suddenly struck her. Then she drew herself up.
You stupid boy,
she said in a voice that was all the more terrible, because it was so quiet.
Finished? You and I? How can you even begin to understand what I have had to do to bring you to this world? You have been my only care for over 1,000 years. I have endured anguish and loss and pain beyond your ability to understand what the words mean. All for you. I have lived in poverty and squalor for hundreds of years at a time. All for you. I gave up a sister I loved more than my life itself. All for you. I have gone through fire and despair worse than a fire 12 times over. All for you. And you think? This has all been an entertainment for me. Some idle amusement. You think the kind of care that I have devoted to you for 1,000 years and more comes cheaply? You and I will never be finished, Belgerian. Never. We will go on together until the end of days, if necessary. We will never be finished. You owe me too much for that.
There was a dreadful silence. The others, shocked by the intensity of Aunt Paul's words, stood staring first at her, and then at Geryon. Without speaking further, she turned and went below decks again. Geryon looked around helplessly, suddenly terribly ashamed and terribly alone.
"I had to do it, didn't I?"
he asked of no one in particular, and not entirely sure exactly what it was that he meant. They all looked at him, but no one answered his question. Chapter 26 By mid-afternoon, the clouds had rolled in again, and the thunder began to rumble off in the distance as the rain swept in to drown the steaming city once more. The afternoon thunderstorms seemed to come at the same time each day, and they had even grown accustomed to it. They all moved below deck and sat sweltering as the rain roared down on the deck above them. Geryon sat stiffly, his back planted against a rough-hewn oak rib of the ship, and watched Aunt Paul, his face set stubbornly, and his eyes unforgiving. She ignored him and sat talking quietly with Tenedra. Captain Greldick came through the narrow companionway door, his face and beard streaming water.
"The Drasnian Droblek is here. He says he got word for you."
"Send him in,"
Beric said. Droblek squeezed his vast bulk through the narrow door. He was totally drenched from the rain and stood dripping on the floor. He wiped his face.
"It's wet out there," he commented.
"We noticed," Hetar said.
"I've received a message," Droblek told Aunt Paul. "It's from Prince Galdar."
"Finally."
"He and Belgareth are coming downriver," Droblek reported. "As closely as I can make out. They should be here in a few days. A week, at the most. The messenger isn't very coherent."
Aunt Paul looked at him inquiringly.
"Fever," Droblek explained. "The man's a Drasnian, so he's reliable. One of my agents at an upcountry trading post. But he's picked up on one of the diseases that infest this stinking swamp. He's a little delirious just now. We hope we can break the fever in a day or so and get some sense out of him. I came as soon as I got the general idea of his message. I thought you'd want to know immediately."
"We appreciate your concern."
"I'd have sent a servant. But messages sometimes go astray in Steely's store, and servants sometimes get things, twisted around."
He grinned suddenly.
"That's not the real reason, of course."
Aunt Paul smiled.
"Of course not."
"A fat man tends to stay in one place and let others do his walking around for him. From the tone of King Rautar's message, I gather that this business might be the most important thing happening in the world just now. I wanted to take part in it."
He made a wry face.
"We all lapse into childishness from time to time, I suppose."
"How serious is the condition of the messenger?"
Droblek shrugged.
"Who can say? Half of these pestilential fevers in Nyssa don't even have names, and we can't really tell one from the other. Sometimes people die very quickly from them. Sometimes they linger for weeks. Now and then someone even recovers. About all we can do is make them comfortable and wait to see what happens."
"I'll come at once," Aunt Paul said, rising. "Durnick, would you get me the green bag from our packs? I will need the herbs I have in it."
"It's not always a good idea to expose oneself to some of these fevers, my lady."
"I won't be in any danger. I want to question your messenger closely, and the only way I will be able to get any answers from him is to rid him of his fever."
"Durnick and I can come along,"
Barak offered. She looked at him.
"It doesn't hurt to be on the safe side,"
the big man said, belting on his sword.
"If you wish."
She put on her cloak and turned up the hood.
This may take most of the night, she told Graldik. There are Grollums about, so have your sailors stay alert. Put a few of the more sober ones on watch.
Sober, my lady? Graldik asked innocently.
I have heard the singing coming from the crew's quarters, Captain. Kyareks do not sing unless they are drunk, she said a bit primly. Keep the lid on your ale barrel tonight. Shall we go, Droblek?
At once, my lady.
The fat man assented with a sly look at Graldik. Geryon felt a certain relief after they had gone. The strain of maintaining his rancor in Aunt Paul's presence had begun to wear on him. He found himself in a difficult position. The horror and self-loathing which had gnawed at him since he had unleashed the dreadful fire upon Khamdar and the wood of the Dryads had grown until he could scarcely bear it. He looked forward to each night with dread, for his dreams were always the same. Over and over again, he saw Khamdar, his face burned away, pleading, Master, have mercy. And over and over again, he saw the awful blue flame that had come from his own hand in answer to that agony. The hatred he had carried since Val Alon had died in that flame. His revenge had been so absolute that there was no possible way he could evade or shift the responsibility for it. His outburst that morning had been directed almost more at himself than at Aunt Paul. He had called her a monster, but it was the monster within himself that he hated. The dreadful catalogue of what she had suffered over uncounted years for him, and the passion with which she had spoken, evidence of the pain his words had caused her, twisted searingly in his mind. He was ashamed, so ashamed that he could not even bear to look into the faces of his friends. He sat alone and vacant-eyed, with Aunt Paul's words thundering over and over in his mind. The rain slackened on the deck above them as the storm passed. Swirling little eddies of raindrops ran across the muddy surface of the river in the fitful wind. The sky began to clear, and the sun sank into the roiling clouds, staining them an angry red. Geryon went up on deck to wrestle alone with his troubled conscience. After a while he heard a light step behind him.
"I suppose that you are proud of yourself?" Tenedra asked acidly. "Oh, leave me alone." "I do not think so. I think I want to tell you just exactly how we all felt about your little speech this morning."
"I don't want to hear about it."
"That's too bad. I'm going to tell you anyway."
"I won't listen."
"Oh, yes, you will."
She took him by the arm and turned him around. Her eyes were blazing and her tiny face filled with a huge anger.
What you did was absolutely inexcusable. Your aunt raised you from a baby. She has been a mother to you.
My mother is dead.
The Lady Palgara is the only mother you ever knew. And what did you give her for thanks? You called her a monster. You accused her of not caring?
I'm not listening to you, Geryon said. Knowing that it was childish, even infantile, he put his hands over his ears. The Princess Tenedra always seemed to bring out the worst in him.
"Move your hands," she commanded in a ringing voice. "You are going to hear me, even if I have to scream."
Geryon, afraid that she meant it, took his hands away.
"She carried you when you were a baby,"
Tenedra went on, seeming to know exactly where the sorest spot on Geryon's wounded conscience lay.
"She watched your every step, your first step. She fed you. She watched over you. She held you when you were afraid or hurt. Does that sound like a monster? She watches you all the time. Did you know that? If you even so much as stumble, she almost reaches out to catch you. I've seen her cover you when you were asleep. Does that sound like someone who does not care?"
"You're talking about something you don't understand. Please, just leave me alone."
"Please," she repeated mockingly. "What a strange time for you to remember your manners. I didn't hear you saying please this morning. I didn't hear a single please. I didn't hear any thank you either. Do you know what you are, Geryon? You are a spoiled child, that's what you are."
That did it. To have this
pampered, willful little princess call him a spoiled child was more than Geryon could bear. Infuriated, he began to shout at her. Most of what he said was wildly incoherent, but the shouting made him feel better. They started with accusations, but the argument soon degenerated into name-calling. Tenedra was screeching like a Kamar fishwife, and Geryon's voice cracked and warbled between a manly baritone and a boyish tenor. They shook their fingers in each other's faces and shouted. Tenedra stamped her feet, and Geryon waved his arms. All in all, it was a splendid little fight. Geryon felt much better when it was over. Yelling insults at Tenedra was an innocent diversion compared to some of the deadly things he had said to Aunt Paul that morning, and it allowed him to vent his confusion and anger harmlessly. In the end, of course, Tenedra resorted to tears and fled, leaving him feeling more foolish than ashamed. He fumed a bit, muttering a few choice insults he had not had the opportunity to deliver, and then he sighed and leaned pensively on the rail to watch night settling over the dank city. Though he would not have cared to admit it, even to himself, he was grateful to the princess. Their descent into absurdity had cleared his head. Quite clearly now he saw that he owed Aunt Paul an apology. He had lashed out at her, out of his own sense of deep-seated guilt, trying somehow to shift the blame to her. Quite obviously, there was no way to evade his own responsibility. Having accepted that, he seemed for some reason to feel better. It grew darker. The tropical night was heavy, and the smell of rotting vegetation and stagnant water rolled in and out of the trackless swamps. A vicious little insect crawled down inside his tunic and began to bite him somewhere between his shoulders where he could not reach it. There was absolutely no warning. No sound or lurch of the ship or any hint of danger. His arms were seized from behind, and a wet cloth was pressed firmly over his mouth and nose. He tried to struggle, but the hands holding him were very strong. He tried to twist his head to get his face clear enough to shout for help. The cloth smelled strange, cloying, sickeningly sweet, thick somehow. He began to feel dizzy, and his struggles grew weaker. He made one last effort before the dizziness overcame him, and he sank down into unconsciousness. Chapter 27. They were in a long hallway of some sort. Geryon could see the flagstone floor quite clearly. Three men were carrying him face down, and his head bobbed and swung on his neck uncomfortably. His mouth was dry, and the thick, sweet smell that had impregnated the cloth they had crushed to his face lingered. He raised his head, trying to look around.
"He's awake," the man holding one of his arms said. "Well, finally," one of the others muttered. "You held the cloth to his face too long, Ethis." "I know what I'm doing," the first one said. "Put him down." "Can you stand?"
Isis asked Geryon. His shaved head was stubbled, and he had a long scar running from his forehead to his chin, directly through the puckered vacancy of an empty eye socket. His belted robe was stained and spotted.
"Get up,"
Isis ordered in a hissing kind of voice. He nudged Geryon with his foot. Geryon struggled to rise. His knees were shaky, and he put his hand on the wall to steady himself. The stones were damp and covered with a kind of mold.
"Bring him,"
Isis told the others. They took Geryon's arms and half-dragged, half-carried him down the damp passageway behind the one-eyed man. When they came out of the corridor, they were in a vaulted area that seemed not so much like a room, but rather a large roofed place. Huge pillars, covered with carvings, supported the soaring ceiling, and small oil lamps hung on long chains from above or sat on little stone shelves on the pillars. There was a confused sense of movement as groups of men in varicolored robes drifted from place to place in a kind of languorous stupor.
You,
Isis snapped at a plump young man with dreamy eyes.
Tell Tzadi, the chief eunuch, that we have the boy.
Tell him yourself,
the young man said in a piping voice.
I don't take orders from your kind, Isis.
Isis slapped the plump young man sharply across the face.
You hit me,
the plump one wailed, putting his hand to his mouth.
You made my lip bleed, see?
He held out his hand to show the blood.
If you don't do what I tell you to do, I'll cut your fat throat,
Isis told him in a flat voice.
I'm going to tell Zadie what you did. Go ahead, and as long as you're there, tell him that we've got the boy the queen wanted.
The plump young man scurried away.
Eunuchs,
one of the men holding Geryon's arm spat.
They have their uses,
the other said with a coarse laugh.
Bring the boy,
Isis ordered.
Zadie does not like to be kept waiting.
They pulled Geryon across the lighted area. A group of wretched-looking men with unkempt hair and beards sat chained together on the floor.
Otter,
one of them croaked.
Please?
He stretched out an imploring hand. Isis stopped to stare at the slave in amazement.
Why does this one still have its tongue?
He demanded of the guard who stood over the slaves. The guard shrugged.
We haven't had time to attend to that yet.
Take time,
Isis told him.
If one of the priests hears it talk, he'll have you questioned. You wouldn't like that.
I'm not afraid of the priests,
the guard said, but he looked nervously over his shoulder.
Be afraid,
Isis advised him.
And what are these animals? They're no good to anyone dead.
He started to lead the men holding Geryon through a shadowy area between two pillars, then stopped again.
Get out of my way,
he said to something lying in the shadows. Grudgingly, the thing began to move. With revulsion, Geryon realized that it was a large snake.
Get over there with the others,
Isis told the snake. He pointed toward a dimly lighted corner where a large mass seemed to be undulating, moving with a kind of sluggish seething. Faintly, Geryon could hear the dry hiss of scales rubbing together. The snake, which had barred their way, flicked a nervous tongue at Isis, then slithered toward the dim corner.
Someday you're going to get bitten, Isis, one of the men warned. They don't like being ordered around.
Isis shrugged indifferently and moved on.
Zadie wants to talk to you,
the plump young eunuch said spitefully to Isis as they approached a large polished door.
I told him that you hit me. Math is with him.
Good,
Isis said. He pushed the door open.
Zadie,
he called sharply.
Tell your friend I'm coming in. I don't want him making any mistakes.
He knows you, Isis, a voice on the other side of the door said.
He won't do anything by mistake.
Isis went in and closed the door behind him.
You can leave now,
one of the men holding Geryon told the young eunuch. The plump one sniffed.
I go when Zadie tells me to go.
And come running when Zadie whistles, too.
That's between Zadie and me now, isn't it?
Bring him in,
Isis ordered, opening the door again. The two men pushed Geryon into the room.
We'll wait out here, one of them said nervously.
Isis laughed harshly, pushed the door shut with his foot, and pulled Geryon to the front of a table where a single oil lamp flickered with a tiny flame that barely held back the darkness. A thin man, with dead-looking eyes, sat at the table, lightly stroking his hairless head with the long fingers of one hand.
Can you speak, boy?
He asked Geryon,
His voice had a strange contralto quality to it, and his silk robe was a solid crimson, rather than berry-colored.
"Could I have a drink of water?" Geryon asked.
In a minute.
"I'll take my money now, Tzadi,"
Issus said.
"As soon as we're sure this is the right boy."
"Ask it what its name is,"
a hissing whisper said from the darkness behind Geryon.
"I will, Mas."
Tzadi looked faintly annoyed at the suggestion.
"I have done this before."
"You're taking too long,"
the whisper said.
"Say your name, boy,"
Tzadi told Geryon.
"Dorun,"
Geryon lied quickly.
"I'm really very thirsty." "Do you take me for a fool, Issus? Did you think just any boy would satisfy me?"
"This is the boy you told me to fetch,"
Issus said.
"I can't help it if your information was wrong."
"You say your name is Dorun?"
Tzadi asked.
"Yes. I'm the cabin boy on Captain Greldick's ship. Where are we?"
"I'll ask the questions, boy," Tzadi said. "It's lying,"
the sibilant whisper came from behind Geryon.
"I know that, Math," Tzadi replied calmly. "They always do at first."
"We don't have time for all of this,"
the hiss said.
"Give it, Oret. I need the truth immediately."
"Whatever you say, Mas,"
Tzadi agreed. He rose to his feet and disappeared momentarily into the shadows behind the table. Geryon heard a clink and then the sound of water pouring.
"Remember that this was your idea, Mas. If she becomes angry about it, I don't want to be the one she blames."
"She'll understand, Tzadi."
"Yeah, boy,"
Tzadi offered, coming back into the light and holding out a brown earthenware cup.
No, thank you. I guess I'm not really thirsty after all." "You might as well drink it, boy. If you don't, Issus will hold you, and I'll pour it down your throat. It isn't going to hurt you."
"Drink,"
the hissing voice commanded.
"Better do as they say,"
Issus advised. Helplessly, Geryon took the cup. The water had a strangely bitter taste and seemed to burn his tongue.
"Much better,"
Tzadi said, resuming his seat behind the table.
"Now, you say your name is Dorun?" "Yes." "Where are you from, Dorun?" "Sindaria."
"Where exactly in Sindaria?"
"Near Dorun on the north coast."
"What are you doing on a Kerrick ship?"
"Captain Greldick's a friend of my father,"
Geryon said. For some reason, he suddenly wanted to explain further.
"My father wanted me to learn about ships. He says that being a sailor is better than being a farmer. Captain Greldick agreed to teach me what I'd need to know to be a sailor. He says I'll be good at it because I didn't even get seasick, and I'm not afraid to climb up the ropes that hold the sails in place, and I'm almost strong enough to pull an oar already, and..."
"What did you say your name was, boy?"
"Geryon. Dorun. Yes, Dorun, and..."
"How old are you, Geryon?"
15, last Eristide. Aunt Paul says that people who are born on Eristide are very lucky, only I haven't noticed that I'm luckier than..."
"And who is Aunt Paul?"
"She's my aunt. We used to live on Faldor's farm, but Mr. Wolf came and we..."
"Do people call her something besides Aunt Paul?"
"King Folrak called her Polgara. That was when Captain Brendick took us all to the palace in Sindar. Then we went to King Anhag's palace in Val Alarn and..."
"Who's Mr. Wolf?"
"My grandfather. They call him Belgarath. I didn't used to believe it, but I guess it has to be true, because one time he..."
And why did you all leave Falda's farm?
I don't know why at first, but then I found out that it was because Zadar stole the orb of Aldur off the pommel of the sword of the Riven King, and we've got to get it back before Zadar can take it to Torak and wake him up and...
This is the boy we want,
the hissing voice whispered. Geryon turned slowly. The room seemed brighter now, as if the tiny flame were putting out more light. In the corner, rearing out of its own coils and with a strangely flattened neck and glowing eyes, was a very large snake.
We can take it to Salmisra now,
the snake hissed. It lowered itself to the floor and crawled across to Geryon. He felt its cold, dry nose touch his leg, and then, though a hidden part of his mind shrieked, he stood, unresisting, as the scaly body slowly mounted his leg and coiled upward until the snake's head reared beside his face and its flickering tongue touched it.
"Be very good, boy,"
the snake hissed in his ear.
"Very, very good."
The reptile was heavy, and its coils thick and cold.
"This way, boy," Sadie told Geryon, rising to his feet.
"I want my money,"
Issus demanded. "Oh," Sadie said almost contemptuously.
"That? It's in the pouch there, on the table."
And then he turned and led Geryon from the room.
"Geryon,"
the dry voice that had always been in his mind spoke quietly to him,
"I want you to listen carefully. Don't say anything or let anything show on your face. Just listen to me."
Who are you?"
Geryon asked silently, struggling with the fog in his brain.
"You know me,"
the dry voice told him.
"Now, listen. They have given you something that makes you do what they want you to do. Don't fight against it. Just relax. Don't fight it."
"But I said things I shouldn't have.
That doesn't matter now. Just do as I say. If anything happens, and it starts to get dangerous, don't fight. I'll take care of it. But I can't do it if you're struggling. You have to relax, so that I can do what has to be done. If you suddenly find yourself doing things or saying things you don't understand, don't be afraid and don't try to fight. It won't be them. It will be me."
Comforted by this silent reassurance, Geryon walked obediently beside Sadi, the eunuch, while the coils of the snake, Ma'ath, lay heavily about his chest and shoulders, and the bluntly pointed reptilian head rested almost nuzzlingly against his cheek. They entered a large room where the walls were heavily draped and crystal oil lamps hung glittering on silver chains. An enormous stone statue, its upper third lost in the shadows high above, raised its mass titanically at one end of the room, and directly in front of the statue was a low stone platform, carpeted and strewn with cushions. Upon the platform stood a heavy divan that was not quite a chair and not quite a couch. There was a woman on the divan. Her hair was raven black, cascading in loose coils down her back and across her shoulders. About her head was an intricately wrought golden crown, sparkling with jewels. Her gown was white and spun of the filmiest gauze. It did not in any way conceal her body, but rather seemed to be worn only to provide a material to which her jewels and adornments could be attached. Beneath the gauze her skin was almost chalky white, and her face was extraordinarily beautiful. Her eyes were pale, even colorless. A large gold-framed mirror stood on a pedestal at one side of the divan, and the woman lounged at ease, admiring herself in the glass. 2 dozen shaven-headed eunuchs in crimson robes knelt in a cluster to one side of the dais, resting on their haunches and gazing at the woman, and the statue behind her with worshipful adoration. Among the cushions at the side of the divan lolled an indolent, pampered-looking young man, whose head was not shaved. His hair was elaborately curled, his cheeks were rouged, and his eyes were fantastically made up.
He wore only the briefest of loincloths, and his expression was bored and sulky. The woman absently ran the fingers of one hand through his curls as she watched herself in the mirror.
"The queen has visitors,"
one of the kneeling eunuchs announced in a sing-song voice.
"Ah,"
the others chanted in unison,
"visitors." "Hail eternal Salmistra,"
Sadie the eunuch said, prostrating himself before the dais and the pale-eyed woman.
"What is it, Sadi?"
she demanded. Her voice was vibrant and had a strange dark timbre.
"The boy, my queen,"
Sadi announced, his face still pressed to the floor.
"On your knees, before the serpent queen,"
the snake hissed in Geryon's ear. The coils tightened about Geryon's body, and he fell to his knees in their sudden, crushing grip.
"Come here, Ma'as,"
Salmisra said to the snake.
"The queen summons the beloved serpent,"
the eunuch intoned.
"Ah," said the others.
The reptile uncoiled itself from about Geryon's body and undulated up to the foot of the divan, reared half of its length above the reclining woman, and then lowered itself upon her body, its thick length curving, fitting itself to her. The blunt head reached up to her face, and she kissed it affectionately. The long forked tongue flickered over her face, and Maas began to whisper sibilantly in her ear. She lay in the embrace of the serpent, listening to its hissing voice and looking at Geryon with heavy-lidded eyes. Then, pushing the reptile aside, the queen rose to her feet and stood over Geryon.
"Welcome to the land of the snake people, Bergeryon,"
she said in her purring voice. The name, which he had heard only from Aunt Paul before, sent a strange shock through Geryon, and he tried to shake the fog from his head.
"Not yet,"
the dry voice in his mind warned him. Salmisra stepped down from the dais, her body moving with a sinuous grace beneath her transparent gown. She took one of Geryon's arms and drew him gently to his feet. Then she touched his face lingeringly. Her hand seemed very cold.
"A pretty young man,"
she breathed, almost as if to herself.
"So young, so warm."
Her look seemed somehow hungry. A strange confusion seemed to fill Geryon's mind. The bitter drink Thadi had given him still lay on his consciousness like a blanket. Beneath it he felt at once afraid and yet strangely attracted to the queen. Her chalky skin and dead eyes were repellent, yet there was a kind of lush invitation about her, an overripe promise of unspeakable delights. Unconsciously, he took a step backward.
"Don't be afraid, my Bergeryon,"
she purred at him.
"I won't hurt you. Not unless you want me to. Your duties here will be very pleasant, and I can teach you things that Palgra hasn't even dreamed of."
"Come away from him, Salmistra,"
the young man on the dais ordered petulantly.
"You know I don't like it when you pay attention to others."
A flicker of annoyance showed on the queen's eyes. She turned and looked rather coldly at the young man.
"What you like or don't like doesn't really concern me anymore, Essia."
"What?"
Essia cried incredulously.
"Do as I say at once."
"No, Essia."
"I'll punish you,"
he threatened.
"No,"
she said.
"You won't. That sort of thing doesn't amuse me anymore, and all your pouting and tantrums have begun to grow boring. Leave now."
"Leave?"
Ezia's eyes bulged in disbelief.
"You're dismissed, Ezia."
"Dismissed? But you can't live without me. You said so yourself."
"We all say things that we don't mean sometimes."
The arrogance went out of the young man like water poured from a bucket. He swallowed hard and began to tremble.
"When do you want me to come back?"
he whined.
"I don't, Asya." "Never?" "Never. Now go and stop making a scene." "What's to become of me?"
he cried. He began to weep, the makeup around his eyes running in grotesque streaks down his face.
"Don't be so tiresome, Asya. Pick up your belongings and leave, now. I have a new consort."
She stepped back up on the dais.
"The queen has a chosen consort," the eunuch intoned.
"Ah," the others chanted.
"Hail the consort of eternal Salmistra, most fortunate of men."
The sobbing young man grabbed up a pink robe and an ornately carved jewel box. He stumbled down from the dais.
"You did this,"
he accused Geryon. "It's all your fault." Suddenly, out of the folds of the robe draped over his arm, he pulled a small dagger.
"I'll fix you,"
he screamed, raising the dagger to strike. There was no thought this time, no gathering of will. The surge of force came without warning, pushing Esia away, driving him back. He slashed futilely at the air with his little knife, then the surge was gone. Esia lunged forward again, his eyes insane and his dagger raised. The surge came again, stronger this time. The young man was spun away. He fell, and his dagger clattered across the floor. Salmistra, her eyes ablaze, pointed at the prostrate Esia and snapped her fingers twice. So fast that it seemed almost like an arrow loosed from a bow, a small green snake shot from beneath the divan, its mouth agape and its hiss a kind of snarl. It struck once, hitting Esia on the leg, then slithered quickly to one side and watched with dead eyes. Esia gasped and turned white with horror. He tried to rise, but his legs and arms suddenly sprawled out from under him on the polished stones. He gave one strangled cry, and then the convulsions began. His heels pattered rapidly on the floor, and his arms flailed wildly. His eyes turned vacant and staring, and a green froth shot like a fountain from his mouth. His body arched back, every muscle writhing beneath his skin, and his head began to pound on the floor. He gave one thrashing, convulsive leap, his entire body bounding up from the floor. When he came down, he was dead. Salmistra watched him die, her pale eyes expressionless, incurious, with no hint of anger or regret.
"Justice is done," the eunuch announced. "Swift is the justice of the Queen of the Serpent People,"
the others replied. Chapter 28. There were other things they made him drink, some bitter, some sickeningly sweet, and his mind seemed to sink deeper with each cup he raised to his lips. His eyes began to play strange tricks on him. It seemed somehow that the world had suddenly been drowned, and that all of this was taking place underwater. The walls wavered, and the figures of the kneeling eunuchs seemed to sway and undulate like seaweed in the endless wash and eddy of tide and current. The lamps sparkled like jewels, casting out brilliant colors in slow-falling showers. Geryon slumped, all bemused, on the dais near Salmisra's divan, her eyes filled with light and his head washed clean of all thought. There was no sense of time, no desire, no will. He briefly and rather vaguely remembered his friends, but the knowledge that he would never see them again brought only a brief passing regret, a temporary melancholy that was rather pleasant. He even shed one crystal tear over his loss, but the tear landed on his wrist and sparkled with such an unearthly beauty that he lost himself utterly in contemplating it.
"How did he do it?"
the queen's voice said somewhere behind him. Her voice was so beautifully musical that the sound of it pierced Geryon's very soul.
"It has power,"
Maas replied, his serpent voice thrilling Geryon's nerves, vibrating them like the strings of a lute.
"Its power is untried, undirected.
But it is very strong. Beware of this one, beloved Salmisra. It can destroy quite by accident.
I will control him,
she said.
Perhaps,
the snake replied.
Sorcery requires will,
Salmisra pointed out.
I will take his away from him. Your blood is cold, Maas, and you have never felt the fires that fill the veins with the taste of Oret or Atar or Caldis. Your passions are also cold, and you cannot know how much the body can be used to enslave the will. I'll put his mind to sleep and then smother his will with love.
Love, Salmisra?
The snake asked, sounding faintly amused.
The term serves us well. As well as any other,
she replied.
Call it appetite, if you wish.
That I can understand,
Maas agreed.
But don't underestimate this one, or overestimate your own power. It does not have an ordinary mind. There's something strange about it that I cannot quite penetrate.
We shall see,
she said.
Zadi,
she called the eunuch.
Yes, my queen. Take the boy. Have him bathed and perfumed. He smells of boats and tar and salt water. I do not like such Aelon smells. At once, eternal Salmisra.
Geryon was led away to a place where there was warm water. His clothes were taken from him, and he was immersed and soaped and immersed again. Fragrant oils were rubbed into his skin, and a brief loincloth was tied about his waist. Then he was taken quite firmly by the chin, and rouge was applied to his cheeks. It was during this process that he realized that the person painting his face was a woman. Slowly, almost incuriously, he let his eyes move around the bath chamber. He realized then that except for Tzadi, everyone there was female. It seemed that something about that should bother him, something having to do with appearing naked in the presence of women, but he could not exactly remember what it was. When the woman had finished painting his face, Tzadi, the eunuch, took his arm and led him again through the dim, endless corridors back to the room where Salmisra half lay on her divan beneath the statue, admiring herself in the pedestaled mirror beside her.
Much better,
she said, looking Geryon up and down with a certain appreciation.
He's much more muscular than I thought. Bring him here.
Tzadi led Geryon to the side of the queen's divan and gently pressed him down onto the cushions where Ethia had lounged. Salmisra reached out with a lingeringly slow hand and brushed her cold fingertips across his face and chest. Her pale eyes seemed to burn, and her lips parted slightly. Geryon's eyes fixed themselves on her pale arm. There was no trace of hair on that white skin.
Smooth,
he said vaguely, struggling to focus on that peculiarity.
Of course, my Belgarian,
she murmured.
Serpents are hairless, and I am the queen of the serpents.
Slowly, puzzled, he raised his eyes to the lustrous black tresses tumbling down across one of her white shoulders.
Only this,
she said, touching the curls with a sensuous kind of vanity.
How? It's a secret,
she laughed.
Some day, perhaps, I'll show you. Would you like that?
I suppose so.
Tell me, Belgarian, do you think I'm beautiful?
I think so.
How old would you say I am?
She spread her arms so that he could see her body through the filmy gauze of her gown.
I don't know. Older than I am, but not too old.
A brief flicker of annoyance crossed her face.
Guess,
she ordered somewhat harshly.
30, perhaps,
he decided, confused.
30?
Her voice was stricken. Swiftly she turned to her mirror and examined her face minutely.
You're blind, you idiot,
she snapped, still staring at herself in the glass.
That's not the face of a woman of 30. 23, 25 at the most.
Whatever you say, he agreed.
23,
she stated firmly.
Not a single day over 23.
Of course, he said mildly.
Would you believe that I am nearly 60?
She demanded, her eyes suddenly flint hard.
No,
Garion denied.
I couldn't believe that. Not 60.
What a charming boy you are, Belgarion.
She breathed at him, her glance melting. Her fingers returned to his face, touching, stroking, caressing. Slowly, beneath the pale skin of her naked shoulder and throat, curious patches of color began to appear, a faint mottling of green and purple that seemed to shift and pulsate, growing first quite visible and then fading. Her lips parted again, and her breathing grew faster. The mottling spread down her torso beneath her transparent gown, the colors seeming to writhe beneath her skin. Maas crept nearer, his dead eyes suddenly coming awake with a strange adoration. The vivid pattern of his own scaly skin so nearly matched the colors that began to emerge upon the body of the Serpent Queen that when he draped a caressing coil across one of her shoulders, it became impossible to say exactly where lay the boundary between the snake and the woman. Had Garion not been in a half-stupor, he would have recoiled from the queen. Her colorless eyes and mottled skin seemed reptilian, and her openly lustful expression spoke of some dreadful hunger. Yet there was a curious attraction about her. Helplessly he felt drawn by her blatant sensuality.
"Come closer, my Belgarion,"
she ordered softly.
"I'm not going to hurt you."
Her eyes gloated over her possession of him. Not far from the dais, Tzaddi, the eunuch, cleared his throat.
"Divine Queen, the emissary of Tauragus requests a word with you."
"Of Tuchik, you mean?"
Tzalmisra said, looking faintly annoyed. Then a thought seemed to cross her mind, and she smiled maliciously. The mottling of her skin faded.
"Bring the Gralam in,"
she instructed to Tzaddi. Tzaddi bowed and withdrew to return a moment later with a scar-faced man in the garb of a Murgo.
"Give welcome to the emissary of Tar Urgoth,"
the eunuch chanted. "Welcome," the chorus replied.
"Carefully now,"
the dry voice in his mind said to Garion.
"That's the one we saw at the harbor."